is this idea that it's useful to try and make things as simple as possible. Of course, the final bit of that maxim is, but no simpler. So I'll also try and talk about how you decide what too simple would be, but how something that's very simple can actually be quite useful. So this is what I'm going to talk about. So I'm going to go back a bit to talking about some work that I did in grad school on parameterizing the cold equation of state, because that sort of spread out in some unexpected ways and has been used in a lot of different places. So I think it's an example of sort of a useful simplification that might be relevant to some of the other things people talk about here this week. I'll talk about the parameterized equations of state that we use in binary neutron star simulations and in black hole neutron star binary simulations, and compare with the current constraints that have been discussed as something that we want to be relevant for. And then I'll talk a bit about how the equation of state effects come into play on the in-spiral, and a little bit on how they come into play in the numerical simulations, focusing on the part before you have before the coalescence phase, where heating and other effects will become more important. And I'll say a little bit about what you expect to measure in a gravitational wave detector. Okay, so first let me say I'm going to sort of go through a bunch of different projects, so I'm not going to stop everywhere for collaborators, but the piecewise polytrope parameterization was done with Ben Lackey and John Friedman and Ben Owen. There's going to be some post-Newtonian perturbative tidal stuff, which I worked on with Tanya Hinderer, as well as Ben and Ryan Lang. And then the numerical simulations that I present without credit to other people are from a collaboration where we took initial data provided by Kaisuke Taniguchi and ran both the WISCI and SACRA codes and then did some analysis. So that's the people that were all involved in that. Okay, so once upon a time, there was a young grad student. She was looking at the set of candidate equations of state for neutron stars, and I guess this was about 2007. And there were a lot of them, and they were all over the place, and it was very difficult when you were trying to contemplate constraining this, because each different equation of state would have some different assumptions in the microphysical model that produced it. So you didn't have, you know, one knob to turn to translate between all the different equations of state. You just had this whole set which had very different parameters characterizing them. And so the grad student's wise advisor assigned her a problem, which was find a systematic way to characterize the set of candidate equations of state above nuclear density, again, this is all cold, with a small number of parameters that are independent of the particular microphysical model, and that, of course, have fitting errors smaller than things you're interested in, so smaller than the current uncertainty in the equation of state, and smaller than the expected range of the constraint you might make on this. So this was sort of the motivation, actually looking at some electromagnetic systems, which since then have been much improved. But this was sort of the motivation that we were looking at this whole set of 30 or so equation of state tables from. And it turned out that you could get pretty good accuracy of almost all the candidates if you just sort of broke it down into a simple piecewise polytrope. So, of course, supernova people have done piecewise polytrope simulations long ago. This isn't, you know, a particularly new idea. But we found out that you could do some things like fix a fiducial density and characterize the pressure at that density. And this pressure is closely linked. This is a relation from Latimer and Prakash. This pressure is closely linked to the radius of the neutron star. So that seems like a useful parameter to know. And then we connected this fiducial pressure with some adiabatic indices in different regions to propagate it down to a fixed crust and up into the high-density core of the star. And with this equation of state at the time, we did some nice constraints. So this is an example of what you can learn with this kind of characterization of equations of state. You can say that for, say, a typical pressure, these are surfaces of a given maximum mass, so that if you measure this maximum mass, your equation of state must have parameters lying above this line. And it turns out that the maximum mass is only sensitive to the high density parts, so the second and third regions above about 1.5 nuclear density. And then if, for example, your pressure at that density is high, then the adiabatic indices can have a bigger range. But if your pressure is low, you start cutting out the possible range of adiabatic indices in the core. So this is sort of the way you get an understanding of what different constraints mean for the underlying function that you're not too sure about. But I moved on sort of from this equation of state constraint stuff, and what we wanted to use this equation, the parameterized equation of state for, was for numerical simulations. Because if all of you do relativistic or computational hydrodynamics, a simulation is quite time expensive. So if you have 30 equations of state, you really don't want to sit there doing 30 simulations. You want to maybe choose some representative set spanning the uncertainty in the equation of state and do your simulations for that set. And then you can get an idea of the range of potential, in this case, waveforms that result from that set. Hopefully get a broad understanding of what's important before you go back and, of course, start varying other parameters besides this first set of waveforms we ran were just varying the pressure and keeping the adiabatic index fixed to sort of cover the span of cold equations of state. But then you can start adding more variation and seeing how important that additional source of variation is to whatever you actually hope to observe. Okay, so this is shifting now from number density to pressure into energy density to pressure, which is why they have started looking a bit different. This is the current set of waveforms that we started running simulations for a couple years ago. So here's just varying the fiducial pressure P, and then we have some more where we vary the adiabatic index around fixed pressure at somewhere around here. And so the thing you kind of want to do now is, oh, we have some new interesting astrophysical constraints. How relevant are our simulations if you believe those astrophysical constraints? So we can take this set of equations of state that we are simulating, and you can look at, for example, the Steiner et al. High density equation of state constraint. That this is the one that constrains. This was the narrower range of radius constraints from the discussions on Monday and Tuesday, and we see that actually we're doing something that's relevant if you believe these constraints. Of course, the astrophysical constraints can be model dependent, and if you look at a different group's interpretation, there's definitely some differences, and we don't cover the parameter range by the Ozell et al. 2010 high-density equation of state constraints. There's issues resolving the neutron star compactnesses that result if you make the equation of state much lower pressure than the ones we're currently running. But so this is sort of to get an idea of how well we're doing and what parameter space is interesting for future runs. You can also compare what we happen to be running with nuclear physics constraints, and this is something that I was actually a bit more worried about because you can see we're not really doing anything very intelligent in the matching between what we use as the core is what we use as the crust. We fix the crust, we change the core, kind of focusing on this density region where most of the matter in the neutron star is, and we just sort of see wherever the two things run into each other. But we're going to be okay as long as you take something that's compatible with the chiral effective field theory thing at the top here. So again, the most of the equations of state that we're actually simulating are falling in a relevant band for what we expect to be the real equation of state. And you can also check that, for example, these differences in the joining are not actually going to make much of a difference into most of the things we're interested in. And I'm going to show this here by showing the difference that the crust-to-core transition makes on the radius, to show that for a typical sort of 1.4 solar mass neutron star, there's very little that changes in the radius when you modify this sort of lower density equation of state. Of course, if you're running binary neutron star in spiral simulations, you may be wondering, well, how do you know that the radius is what you want to look at? The idea now is you want some sort of characteristic macroscopic neutron star property that you expect to be significant in your simulation, because then you can test whether various microphysics is going to affect the property that you're interested in. So to do that, I'm going to sort of step back a bit and talk about how we know what the matter effects in a binary system are, or how we can think about them. Okay. So start off with considering just two bodies freely falling or orbiting each other, or in some way behaving with their point particle behavior taken as given. Then the residual effect on the metric around them, on the gravitational fields, is the tidal deformation. This is the same as in the Earth-Moon system or anything like that. So the amount of deformation is going to induce some resulting change in the gravitational potentials, and this is what's going to be relevant for gravitational waves. So we can characterize this for a realistic equation of state by a single parameter. So this is a combination of the radius of the neutron star and the Love number, which together characterize how the metric around the neutron star deforms in response to an external tidal field. And this is, of course, this is a perturbative linear approximation result, but the nice thing is that it gives you functions of mass, or actually a single function that's a combination of the two of mass. And you can characterize everything the neutron star does in the early in-spiral that affects the waveform by this one number. And since actually K varies not exceedingly much, and the R is to the fifth power, you can actually do pretty well if you just look at the radius. And you can see that, okay, when I do a neutron star in spiral, most of what I will actually be able to see is going to be determined by the radius. So this gives you a diagnostic as to what's important for your physics, what's going to change the radius of the neutron star. Okay, so we can actually do a first estimate of the effect of the equation of state on the neutron star in spiral with this leading order calculation. So we explicitly incorporate into a post-Newtonian energy balance, where you have the gravitational binding energy of the orbit, and you've got the luminosity, and then the system will evolve by how this energy is carried away in time, and that changes the separation, which I've characterized here by the separation by R. So when you put in tidal corrections to this, it comes into both things. So you've got two things happening here. Okay. So first, some of the energy is going into deforming the star at a given separation. So that changes the energy at a given separation. And the second thing you do is that those quadrupole deformations of the tidal bulges are orbiting to track the other star. And that's giving you a little extra quadrupole moment that will add in a little bit of extra gravitational wave luminosity. So you can put these effects directly into the calculation. And this is a calculation of the measurability of the lambda parameter, which is the combination of radius and Love number, as well as actually the measurability of something called the chirp mass and the mass ratio, which together characterize the two masses of the system. And this is at 50 megaparsecs averaged over the sky. And so these are very high signal-to-noise ratio signals. These are something that you would expect to see one to a few percent of the total number of signals seen by advanced LIGO. So this is maybe one every couple years up to a few per year. But you can see with at least a few of these systems, you get quite a lot of precision in the mass. And, well, oh, actually, if you look at realistic equations of state, you see that this lambda parameter is something like 5, unless you have a very extreme equation of state, which gives a very large radius, in which case you can actually constrain that even with advanced LIGO. But for most, excuse me, for most realistic equations of state, you don't expect to see something as long as you're looking only at the Eulerian spiral before 450 hertz. So the model that we're using, this post-Newtonian and perturbative model, is very accurate up to about 450 hertz. It's a single parameter, it's really a single parameter clean signal. But if you extrapolate from this range where you get fairly loose constraints on what the tidal deformability is into the high frequency range where the stars merge, you see that your ability to pull information out of the waveform is very sensitive to how high frequency you have a good waveform model. So if we want to pull equation of state information out of an advanced LIGO signal, we're going to need to model the waveform from the Eulerian spiral and continuously through to the final merger. Unfortunately, this is not easy to do. If you do a similar estimate, similar extrapolation in mixed binaries, you see that the in-spiral alone is not actually significantly different for sort of realistic equations of state like APR. The in-spiral alone has a very high overlap with your post-Newtonian template. So for mixed binaries, you don't expect to see anything. Here you only see something if you push it to high frequency as well. But you can hope then that in the merger, that you'll be able to see differences in the merger waveform, which also give you information about the equation of state. And so I'm going to present a little bit about some very nice work that's been done mostly by Ben Lackey, who you can ask questions about this later since he's here. But this is a set of, again, mixed binary merger simulations. The simulations are run by the group in Kyoto at YITP. And then the thing that we're going back here to the parameterized equation of state. So we have this fiducial pressure at about 1.5 times nuclear density. And then we have the adiabatic index through the whole core. So we've simplified things. Instead of doing multiple regions, we're doing a single region. But this was actually a pretty good approximation for a fair number of realistic equations of state. And these blue dots are the simulations done for a whole set of equations of state. And these lines here are lines of constant radius through this parameter space. So you can see that the pressure parameter for sort of average equations of state is pretty much characterizing the radius. If you have this fixed pressure here, you have about a fixed radius of 12 kilometers. And then they skew off a bit with the adiabatic index away from that. Yeah?
What was the mass ratio here? And was there a spin considering these mixed binaries?
There's a number of sets, some of varying mass ratio, and are there varying spins, Ben? Okay, so spins are in progress. Currently, the examples I'm showing here are with a mass ratio of 3. So these are the actual waveforms with mass ratio of 3, but there's other mass ratios and things that have been studied or are being studied. And the kind of result you get from this is, okay, so this is the merger of a black hole and a neutron star. So you don't expect the perturbative or the radius to necessarily be the thing that's characterizing this, even though you might hope or assume so. But when you look at the error ellipses, so this is error ellipses in the Einstein telescope, so they're quite small. You look at the error ellipses that you get from a particular gravitational wave measurement, and what you see is that you actually will be basically constraining your equation of state to lie on a surface of roughly constant R. So this is actually kind of not obvious, that the merger of a binary neutron or a black hole neutron star binary is probing something almost as simple as the radius of the neutron star. Of course, it's quite another thing to figure out exactly how the radius translates into a waveform. But you at least know what the important parameter seems to be. Okay. We can try and do something similar with numerical simulation of binary neutron stars. Here you actually have a disadvantage almost because of this early decoherence from the phase contribution in the post-Newtonian regime. It's actually harder to compare two neutron star binary simulations with each other. But you can get a pretty good idea. For example, so here's a phenomenological binary black hole amplitude compared to various gravitational wave detectors at a reference optimally oriented 100 megaparsec system. And you can see as you change to a binary neutron star, the end of the in spiral is modified. And then if you change the equation of state, this is actually the unphysically or maximally or very large radius, probably more than you realistically expect, you get quite a significant change. But we can look at varying the waveform between, for example, I'm going to show two examples. This is one that has a radius of about 1.6 kilometers, and this has a radius of 10.9 kilometers. And that fairly small change in radius can make quite a difference. Oops. In the gravitational wave signal. So you see two things. You see that the in spiral itself changes, and you also see this, here you see this hypermassive remnant which oscillates for some period after the coalescence. And here you see a prompt collapse to a black hole and a small something like a ring down, but it does not have the amplitude of a binary black hole ring down of the sort of deformed black hole and matter around it. For these equations of state? So we haven't done a lot of mass, binary mass variation for these equations of state, so I don't know where the threshold is. I don't have that here. It's actually, I believe it's this, the blue one. So, yeah. Okay. One thing I might actually point out, this wasn't an experiment we did quite intentionally. There was a miscommunication in specifying the equation of state for comparison, but half of these equations of state are fixed to be exactly cold. Half of these waveforms are run with the equation of state fixed to be cold, and the other have an effective thermal component added. So where the surfaces hit each other, there's shock heating and some heat added. For the purposes of the gravitational waveform, this does not necessarily make much difference, as you can see here. So you can take your range of equations of state and you can make some estimates about what kind of information you can pull out with a 100 megaparsec away optimally oriented system. If you look at the numerical waveforms alone, you don't trust your procedure for matching to the low frequency regime. You get something like plus or minus 1 kilometer for the sort of typical radius. If you can do a hybrid construction, which includes the post-Newtonian effects earlier in the waveform, the measurement actually goes down a bit to plus or minus 0.5 kilometer. And of course, if you have the Einstein telescope, you're extremely sensitive to radius. So that would allow you to sensitively probe the cold equation of state at high density. However, the hybrid construction also has more caveats and systematics. You can also consider whether you would be able to independently measure the post-merger signal. And that's the estimates I've done seem to indicate that that's mostly going to be possible only in the Einstein telescope. The signal-to-noise ratios are small in advanced LIGO. However, these estimates are very dependent on the stability of the post-merger oscillation. So while the frequency doesn't change significantly with additional microphysics, the length of time the object is stable is certainly going to be very sensitive to a lot of stuff that we aren't properly including in these simulations. So that's definitely a gravitational wave relevant characteristic that that improved microphysics is necessary to pull out. Okay, and that's all I plan to talk about. So do I have more time? Or? Oh, what? Jeez, I thought I was going to be way over. Okay, well, then I have some interesting things that I've sort of thought about over the last couple days. So here's another more explicit estimate of how much microphysics is going to change these post-merger oscillation frequencies from a relatively recent work from Boswin and Janka. So this is kind of interesting. This is a Shin equation of state. I'm afraid I don't know which one. And this is a Latimer-Swesty equation of state. Again, I'm not sure exactly which one. But the red and green curves are taking a cold equation of state, taking the composition of an equilibrium cold equation of state, and putting in an effective thermal pressure the same way that it was done in the simulations I was talking about earlier, which the effective thermal pressure here is sort of a bit of an underestimate and a bit of an overestimate, and it's also assumed to be constant throughout the star. The black is a hot equation of state, so thermal evolution is happening with a realistic equation of state. The composition is not done with sort of neutrino transport and stuff, but it's fixed to the initial values of the star. So these sort of bracket the extremes not all the extremes, but give some sort of idea of the impact that composition is going to have on this particular kind of signature. The other thing that I wanted to show is that the cold equation of state is a very important in determining the immediate behavior of the system. So that is whether it collapses promptly to a black hole, and also the cold equation of state has an impact. Before you add in all the other microphysics, on how long the remnant stays stable. So these ones are stable more than 10 milliseconds, and type 2 are stable less than 10 milliseconds. And this can vary quite a lot over equations of state. And the torus mass produced will also be basically larger the longer the remnant lives. So you can't, you know, just sort of disregard the cold equation of state when you start adding in other microphysics. I mentioned this at one point in the last while, and I guess this may not be something that's been reproduced in fully relativistic simulations, although perhaps that's because it's hard to, you know, resolve little bits getting scattered off like that in a fully relativistic simulation. But this is sort of a neat thing that Ushlin, Janka, and Marek paper, that the ejecta from mergers of equal masses came mostly from an interface where they collided together and it was heated quite a lot. So that's substantially going to be sort of different behavior than ejecta that comes out from a tidal tail in this very unequal mass simulation. So it's interesting to consider if that's you know, if you have some portion of the matter ejected at high temperature, that could potentially be interesting too. And I guess I have lots of time for discussion. Thank you.
Questions?
So I was hoping you and maybe others could talk more about the microphysics that determines the lifetime of this final configuration.
I'm probably not the best person to answer that. I know that all the stuff about magnetic instabilities, neutrino production, and additional pressures from thermal and other things are going to be, it's going to be very sensitive to that. It's sensitive to, the collapse is sensitive to turbulence, and I should ask other people to say if I've missed major components.
What I can say from Korkola simulations is that in that case, just by differential rotation, winding up magnetic field, or maybe use some MRI, you can redistribute it very, very rapidly. The angular momentum is transported outwards in dynamical timescales. But I think the problem is different here, because here you have a surface. In Korkolas, you can transport the angular moment outwards to whatever radius you want, basically. So you don't have any limitation. Here you have a surface, and, the angular momentum has to go at some place. Probably something like that, but it's you have to simulate that to see exactly what happens.
Sure, and you don't necessarily need you can just wind up the field, and that's important as a source of generating a magnetic field. You don't need an instability necessarily. So, yeah, Christian.
So the zeroth order of microphysics is really just the stiffness of the cold EOS.
Right.
That's the zeroth order thing. We think, at least I think, that we understand the temperature dependence, you need to be 10, 20 higher and more MeV before you actually see a thermal effect. So that is then where all the other things like neutrino cooling and redistribution of angular momentum come in. But that redistribution of angular momentum is actually not microphysics. Just dynamical evolution of the system that it would do in the absence of neutrinos.
Perhaps it's not impossible that you get a pretty good estimate just using the cold equation of state in some effective or small effective thermal contribution.
We looked at that in the black hole formation stuff that Evan and I did, and we get 20-30% enhancement just by thermal effects of the maximum mass. So that's one thing, even if the thing is non-rotating. If it's rotating, you can get... Is he here? No, he's not here, of course. He has the numbers. But rotation, in particular differential rotation, can bump up the maximum mass a huge amount. So that will be the other thing. But the thermal contribution is something like 20-30% at 50 MeV or something like that, and it's probably not going to get that hot. So it may well be that the actual, thermal microphysics, so probably you shouldn't be quoting me on that, because next year we may have a different perspective on this, but it may well be that the actual time to black hole formation is really something that's more determined by redistribution of angular momentum than any of the microphysical effects.
Does that imply that that small resolution turbulence and stuff like that is going to come into play? That would be the limiting factor on our curranding.
Well, you can, and I think people have started to do that. You can probe the extreme. You may not be able to resolve the MRI starting with a magnetic field of 10 to the 12, but you can resolve it if you start with a huge magnetic field and you can look at its effect. Or you could even put in by hand something that very efficiently redistributes angular momentum on a short time scale and see, bracket the parameter space of possible things that could happen. That's one thing that would allow us to explore it before we have, can go up a factor of 10 resolution. So that fact going up a factor of 10 resolution wouldn't be bad, because once we have made the black hole, we need to, resolve the horizon. And I have serious doubts that any of these calculations in a convergent way resolve the horizon.
I mean, once it's collapsing to a black hole.
Yeah, and then the subsequent evolution.
Once you're down to torus densities, then thermal effects are going to be more significant than in the densities of the
typical. Yeah, no, I'm just talking about the numerical relativity aspect of it, right? If your constraints, Hamiltonian constraint, momentum constraints go out through the roof, you can't trust the overall evolution anymore. And I believe these simulations, so I'm not, not familiar with the details, but I having done black hole formation in BSSN, I have my worries about the convergence and reliability of the results after the black hole has been formed. But that's not something you're addressing here. I'm just making a general statement.
I mean, I've not even shown the way these continue.
Jocelyn, can you show again the pictures of the shift in frequency once you add microphysics? So do these systems eventually form a black hole, or do they last a long time? I'm not familiar with this work.
I'm not sure if they... Yeah. The main thing here is the effect on the frequency, which...
Well, but what I'm going after here is, so there is this, what I referred to earlier, there is this tension between the, say, non-fully GR simulations and the rest. And the fully GR simulations seem to have a black hole formation a lot sooner than the other counterparts. So I wonder how much of these will stay there. Have you done these with the GR and things just being shut off?
I didn't do this work.
Right. So now I'm just asking if you knew.
I mean, we do get fairly general or fairly generic post-merger oscillations with, I mean, that the relevant thing for this is here where anything, almost everything below that's around 2.7 solar masses total, so 2.35, 2.35, which is, pretty average for binary neutron stars, tends to give a hypermassive neutron star remnant in a relativistic calculation.
Right. So that I don't disagree. What I'm after is how long does that hypermassive neutron star stay there? Because the answer to that question will inform us how to add extra physics in the simulations. So if we're talking about 10 milliseconds or 100 milliseconds, then you are doing two different things.
So in this case, that will depend. The type 2 ones are less than 10 milliseconds. The type 3 ones are more, up to 20 milliseconds.
But just consider this. Let's say you're 20% above the cold maximum. Well, no, your system has a mass that's 20% over the cold maximum mass. But you have thermal support because of your microphysics that above that, right? Then the thing can survive on the cooling time scale of that thermal support.
It's probably more differential rotation.
Also differential rotation.
Sure, but I mean that helps. But at the same time, I throw in magnetic fields, and then they can take angular momentum out, and then so we have tensions going back and forth.
Yeah, so but, you know, I feel I have to defend the CFC thing a little bit. I think that the CFC SPH code that they're using, the onset for stability or instability is not so different. We've tested years ago, in fact, Harry Dimmermeyer, who has a CFC code, and I compared them, BSSN versus CFC, and we found for cases that would collapse to a black hole, the actual code would crash once it would collapse because the metric wouldn't converge. But the actual instability onset was pretty similar.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to refer in any negative way. I'm just saying that there is this tension that slowly we're building towards a consensus, but it still is the case that there are different numbers.
Yeah, but they actually have a lot better microphysics than most of the full calculations. So I think we'll be able to compare with them once the full numerical GR models are at the same level, and then we'll get a clearer picture.
So do you have fresh in the back of your mind what people like Lee and Ramirez Ruiz are getting with their SPH and Newtonian base codes? When they merge neutron stars, how long do they last?
Well, they last forever. In Newtonian, there's no collapse of a black hole.
Well, but they drive things with a potential. So I'm trying to see if they have an estimate.
Oh, you mean with the Levy Civita? Yeah. I do not know how long they last. This is a lot more wrong than CFC is wrong. So
you're saying it.
Than due to the CFC. I mean, you have to think that the error that you're making is just roughly you are neglecting the back reaction of the gravitational waves. So if you think that this is important in this case, well, then it's important. But if you think it's small, then, I mean, this is the error. Well, so it's an approximation to that.
This is the gravitational wave signal. This spike here, so that...
Well, via the quadrupole formula.
Yeah.
Yes. This won't be exactly right.
No.
It's the quadrupole gravitational wave, and this potential are pretty deep. The quadrupole formula, to our great surprise, does amazingly well. So I wouldn't be surprised if things don't shift very much, provided, we numerical relativity guys get actually implementation of the microphysics, right?
Well, yeah, so what I was going after was I was just trying to pick up on Matt Dewey's final comment towards the end of his talk when he said, well, some of the things that people in the general relativity community or numerical relativity community are beginning to put in are very crude ways of accounting for the microphysics. There are things that we're obviously neglecting. But if we set the stage of that the constraint is the system is going to last, or the hypermassive neutron star is going to last, like, say, 20, 30 milliseconds at most before the black hole forms. How much, just please shoot your favorite answer, how much are we missing by not including it? I mean, are we obviously missing some important piece of physics that we should absolutely put in rather than looking at, the next thing or running more simulations to inform LIGO?
So if you believe observation, the mass distribution of pulsar, double pulsar binary or double neutron star binaries, then they seem to be towards the lower end, right? Like 1.3, maybe 1.4. And if the maximum mass is above 2.4 solar masses, and if you count in differential rotation, you count in thermal support, then these things probably, and that's my guess, last many tens of milliseconds. And sure, you need to include, you want to have at least some kind of neutrino cooling to get rid of the thermal part. Potentially these things, if you merge two 1.2 solar mass neutron stars, as I think Anasa pointed out earlier, these things will survive for a very long time, maybe forever.
Right, so the problem
and then,
is that
then
not
you have all the mess.
Everything.
Right? Once you have a black hole, you're happy because you don't have to worry about the microphysics. But
if you want to start talking about the disk, and that's an arrow kind of worms.
Yeah. If we are just interested in the wave signal, then obviously it's going to be the equation of state is going to be the most important thing, the cold equation of state, because that seems to be controlling the wave signal, as Jocelyn has pointed out, even in the post-merger evolution. That's news to me, and, you know, it sort of makes people happy that I've been fighting against. But that seems to be the most important group. If that's the only thing you want, you're done. If you're interested in what actually is going to happen on the neutrino side, and if you're interested in what's going to happen on the EM side, yes, you need to dump as much as possible.
No, right, absolutely. But say we go on as people are already showing, the leakage scheme. Do people believe that? I mean, that accounts for some of the cooling of the neutrinos will produce. When it's not taken into account the advection, do people believe that we're missing in something?
Well, you're
important?
Blowing off a neutrino-driven wind, right? And in particular, if your neutron star survives for a long time, you have a huge luminosity, you're going to have, you know, charged current absorption, you're driving a wind. So if you want to make predictions for out-process nucleosynthesis of this stuff, yeah, sure. You can't do it without this. But you can also go, you take the leakage scheme and you put on top of it a simple heating scheme by, you know, looking at what's coming in from below. So I have a certain luminosity and then I have some kind of cross-section. So you can always, you know, fake it and see what the effect of it is. And that would be my recommendation. Ultimately, you want to do a full radiation transfer model of this, but, you know, that's going to take time, in particular in GR and in 3D. But if the goal of I think of the community is ultimately to connect with real astrophysics, so and that for that we need everything.
Can you guess what you need most importantly for real astrophysics? I guess it depends what in particular you're trying to look at. But I mean, if you had a priority,
Everything else, you know, the ejecta, the EM signature, and so on, that will be will be very, very dependent on the neutrinos. So I would recommend doing neutrinos in terms of microphysics once the equation of state is there.
Is there an estimate for the contribution to the pressure of a given mass element from neutrino production?
It can be up to 20% just below saturation density.
Okay.
That's the case in a core collapse. In the high-density component, it's negligible compared to the strong force. But just below saturation density, if you plot the neutrino pressure versus the pressure from the coming from the EOS, you get a peak of the ratio at around... at around saturation density in core collapse. So I would expect that in that hot mantle that's neutrino trapped, their neutrino pressure will be significant.
Okay.
But again, that's something it's easy to include in an approximate way that's okay, because you're above a certain density, you're confident that the neutrinos are trapped, and then you just treat them like Fermi gas. So, and then you take a gradient of the Fermi pressure. It's actually easy to include that.
Okay.
You got to be careful when you cut it off and so on. But the effect, it's easy to include. It's a switch, and you can try out what effect it has. I, again, think it's not going to make a huge difference on the wave signal. But it's going to change the details, and it's going to make the entire simulation a little bit more like nature. Code that does that is included in GR1D, and there's an entire leakage scheme available in GR1D, which is an open source code which you can get from stellarcollapse.org. You can just download it and use it and do whatever you want. Make sure you check what you're doing, because you're not taking any responsibility for your results, but you need to worry about that.
An And I totally agree with Christian, and people in the Masaru's group is now implementing the leakage scheme in the simulation of binary star, you know, neutron star binary. You will get the data soon, so you can, you know, make the analysis, you know. So I think it's very good. Yeah, I mean, it's very important. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, you will soon get the, you know, get the data from Masaru's group.
Okay.
Using leakage. So, yeah. So let's see the difference.
If there, I might also ask, so I guess I asked this on Monday, and people seemed pessimistic, but I'm just wondering, looking at these hot equations of state with temperature and composition dependence, what are, one thing is that when we started doing these simple piecewise polytrope things, some of the microphysics people got kind of angry. I'm not angry, but I mean, you're discarding all this physics. You know, you're just, well, you, I don't know. And then lots of different, like, people who worked on the nuclear physics side are like, you're discarding all this physics, even in the pure cold equation of state by just fitting these simple functions to it. And the sort of the response was, well, actually, all that the neutron star sees is the pressure density function. It doesn't actually see what's providing that pressure density function. So it was actually sort of useful to focus on what would translate into the kind of observables we are looking at. So is there some, you know, simplified form that you can use for the additional components of microphysics where you can, you know, just turn a knob like this sort of fiducial pressure to go cover the range of uncertainties in the microphysics of all the stuff that happens when you have composition and temperature mattering? Maybe. Someone should do that. So when are we going to get small number of parameters to cover the space of hot equations of state? Well, yeah. I mean, that's certain. I mean, there's.
What difference does it make whether you change the parameters or whether you replace the equation of state table, right? It's still the same number of parameters.
Yeah, but so my argument was we actually gained something by just having something we could change systematically,
right,
and see how different
so we need a family
different
of
knobs.
US tables that change,
yeah.
The relevant parameters systematically.
Mm-hmm. So what? So do all the microphysical people agree on what the knobs are that you want to turn? Is there any phenomenological set of knobs that could be constructed?
Would be a nice paper. No, I think that would be one very important thing that, you know, MICRA intends to do, right? Bring together people.
Bring together the relevant people, in particular, you know, people like you who have been looking at this from this phenomenological point of view, and then talking to the nuclear physicists and trying to figure out what are these knobs that we want to turn, and what is the effect, and how can we probe the parameter space that's allowed. So we saw these plots that Evan made were showing the different regions. We may be a little uncertain about the observational stuff, but we can be relatively certain about the actual theoretical stuff based on the neutron equation of state below saturation.
The other advantage you get with something like this is that, you know, instead of just having a set of candidate equations of state, which, you know, just get updated every few years and the old ones just drop away, I mean, if you you can sort of cover the parameter space to what you are to the accuracy that you decide is important at that time. And if someone has a new equation of state, you can say, oh, we studied it because it's in between these ones and this is its effect.
But maybe if we have actually probed the parameter space of these equations of state. The thing is also with the the composition dependence is not going to have a huge effect because in the cold part, right, the composition, the only compositional variable that you still have there also is just YE. And it's not going to change much in the cold core of the object.
Going further.
Because everything is trapped, right? So the better equilibrium will adjust a little bit because the temperature, you know, once the two neutron stars have merged, it will be hot and so on. So the better equilibrium conditions will change, but it's not going to be, you know, it's not going to the YE dependence of the US is not the thing that is a problem, I think.
This is actually why I found this ejecta thing particularly interesting. Because if you think about the history of those red particles, they start out on the outer edge of the star, so they're at low enough density that when they get smashed together, they're going to probably get put up in density perhaps faster than equilibrium can be maintained. And if those then get ejected, that's the matter that's getting ejected.
That stuff will not be in better equilibrium.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know what, if that is interesting.
Yeah, it's a slow density ejecta that's probably pretty hot from something will happen.
It depends on what temperature, but you can sort of do something like, so if this is log P and log density, and you have, or if you have sort of the full equation of state, which, I don't know, does something like this, at least at low temperatures, you have something kind of coming up like this from like T of 10 to the 7, T of 10 to the 8. And so this here is 10 to the 11 grams per centimeter cubed. Here is 10 to the 14. I'm not sure exactly where for the crust, it's still cold up to about 10 to the 8 Kelvin. And then I'm not sure when you start to have significant thermal pressure going into the... Sorry? If you put temperature into... Oh. Let me try. So can you compare temperature to the Fermi energy? I just think in pressure all the time, so I don't have that off my head. You have that?
So we need to break for coffee. So why don't we look at the plot right first thing after we come back at 4:30?